get to our regular feature with Jim Hightower later in the hour, but we're going to spend the bulk of the show today talking with Anne Wright. She has a whole lot to talk about. I got to had the privilege of hearing her speak in Peterborough, New Hampshire this weekend, and we may be hard pressed to fit her, you know, her comments into an hour and a half or 2 hours. So we should give her plenty of time. Good morning.
Good morning, Jim.
Yeah. So Anne Wright resigned from the U.S. Foreign Service on March 19, 2003, while she was serving as the deputy chief of the mission at the U.S. Embassy in Mongolia. She resigned due to her disagreement with the Bush administration's decision to go to war in Iraq without the authorization of the U.N. Security Council, lack of effort in resolving the Israel-Palestinian situation, the lack of policy on North Korea, and the unnecessary curtailment of civil liberties in the United States. Now, that's a whole lot of issues to resign over. Let's see, could you rank your concerns in sort of order of priority?
Well, in that's truth. I mean, what else didn't I agree with the administration on? Just about everything, as it turned out. Certainly the war in Iraq was the tipping point for me on a variety of issues, foreign policy issues, that the administration was dealing poorly with, I felt. The war in Iraq, I felt, without the approval, the authorization of the UN Security Council for the United States to take essentially a unilateral action, although I guess the British government would dispute that, although the British people certainly are horrified about what their government's going along with the United States on invading and occupying an oil-rich Arab country. The rationale, weapons of mass destruction, I really didn't have any more concrete information than the American public had or was given by the administration, but it certainly was my feeling that Saddam Hussein, if he had any of those weapons, which there were plenty of voices saying he doesn't have them, but even if he had them, the probability of his using them, I felt, was very, very low because he knew exactly what the reaction was going to be of the international community, which was to come in really fast and really hard on him. So I didn't feel it was, if he had anything, it really wasn't a threat. And indeed, the threat to the national security of the United States was not at all on Iraq. It was, to me, going after the people that perpetrated the events of 9/11. I mean, the al-Qaeda guys that flew airplanes into our buildings.
And none of them were even from Iraq, never mind had any connections with the Iraqi government.
Well, that's right. I mean, they were all Saudis. Yeah. Weren't Iraqis, weren't Afghans, weren't they were from Saudi Arabia. And for the United States to divert the attention of the American public from really where the true threats to America were coming from, to me, just made no sense at all. And particularly since I had volunteered and gone to Afghanistan to reopen the U.S. Embassy there in December of 2001, and having seen how much more the international community needed to do, I felt it was the diversion of resources, of all types of resources, from military resources to economic development funds, to Iraq was a danger to the real threats to our society.
So it's sort of, we're already involved in one war. Is this the time to go off and do another one and leave this one unfinished
in some way? But particularly, I mean, diverting into a war that had not a thing to do with our national security and leaving undone what we really needed to accomplish in going after al-Qaeda. And if you say that, well, the side of al-Qaeda, at least at one time, was Afghanistan and the training camps there, we were sorely behind the power curve in Afghanistan. And having spent 5 months there and seen it with my own eyes, then here it was a year and a half later, and then we were going on to this thing of Iraq. Really just from both the military sense and having been in the military myself for 29 years, 13 years on active duty and 16 in the reserves, and having been in conflicts such as in Grenada and Panama and Somalia and Sierra Leone and then Afghanistan, this whole diversion of resources for a war that didn't need to be happening just made no military sense, and it made no foreign policy sense.
So you, as a reasonable citizen, you know, living in Mongolia, you came to your own conclusions, and then surprisingly, you expressed those conclusions to your superiors. Those of us listening in Peterborough were surprised, I think, in a lot of cases, that the State Department allows so much dissent within the Foreign Service.
There is a special channel, as we call it, the dissent channel, where a person that's, say, in the far reaches of the steppes of Mongolia, serving their country out there, and sees some type of foreign policy that they believe is going in the wrong direction or can be improved, there's the opportunity for you to have to send criticism, suggestions on how to do things better directly to the top. So I sent my dissent cable on the folly of going into Iraq directly to Colin Powell, bypassing my ambassador. He never knew that I sent it, because that's part of the deal, that your direct superiors do not know what you're doing. They are not informed. You just send a cable around the system to the very top. Of course, that has its dangers, although they say that there's no retribution, no retaliation. Nobody but the very senior people will ever even know that you have dared challenge something. That's not really true. Yeah. You know, the word kind of gets out every now and then. But
and also there are the tech guys who know that you at least utilize the channel and say, aha, people utilizing the channel are to be suspected.
Well, or actually, and in this case, or they might just mention to you as you're standing by the coffee machine, you know, that was a really good cable you sent out, or I really agree with you. Or, you know, they just inadvertently may let something slip that they have sent something for you that nobody else in the whole embassy knows about. And then all of a sudden, eyes start going up or ears start going up, and particularly if you're a direct boss. Although I only had one supervisor above me in the embassy, and that was the ambassador himself, because I was the deputy ambassador. But anyway, the bottom line was that my dissent cable, I think, reflected the grave concerns of a majority of people in the State Department. And after I actually resigned and sent in my letter of resignation by cable from Mongolia to Washington, I received in the next couple of days over 400 emails from colleagues in the State Department saying that they were horrified about what was going on with Iraq, and thanked me for being one of three Foreign Service officers that ultimately resigned, and then expressing their rationale of why they could not resign. Either they had, you know, kids in college, kids in high school, new houses, new cars. Financially, they just couldn't quite do it. But on morally, they felt it was right for me to do it.
Yeah. So, yeah, they felt it was right for you to do it, and maybe some of them urged you to stay on, you know, to reconsider or something, because we need some diversity of views here.
Well, that's right. I mean, there are plenty of diversities of views in the State Department. I mean, if you really look at the history of what happened in Iraq, the State Department was trying to put the brakes on this whole thing, and their little engine in this great train of the U.S. government was run over by giant locomotives of Department of Defense and the National Security Council and the Vice President's office. But the State Department, its legal counsel, warned that going to war like that would be a criminal act, as did the legal counsel for the equivalent of the State Department in Great Britain, the Foreign and Commercial Office. Their legal advisor warned Tony Blair against it. Their equivalent to the Attorney General also warned him against it, until like 8 days before the war started, when their Attorney General apparently got arm-twisted by other members of the cabinet, and he changed, did a 180-degree turn. And Blair and his government are now, you know, 8 days out from their election. There's a grand squabble going on in the UK about who knew what when, and really whether the Attorney General was, for political purposes, turned on this thing.
Yeah, and in Britain, I guess the Labour Party is likely to win no matter what. So it's a matter of squabbles within the Labour Party. So it has a parallels with the Republicans squeaking by and getting in again here. Mm-hmm. We're in some sense both one-party states or very lopsided systems right now.
Tragically, we are. We certainly in our country need to widen the political scene here, and I think the American public have a really fine opportunity right now to get some people out there and get some organizations going that offer the American public some real choices and not just the old Democrat and Republicans, because there are some good splits. I mean, there are some moderate Republicans and some Democrats that ought to be coming together on serious issues that affect not only our domestic life but our international life.
Need a new paradigm. Now, mm-hmm. getting back to Iraq, I guess there's the history of the U.S. and Iraq has taken lots of odd turns. The support for Saddam for many years, the twists and turns within the Iran-Iraq war, and the apparent support of the U.S. for the gassing of the Kurds at the time, and then the attack of the Iraqi attack on Kuwait, the U.S. sudden enmity against them, the war, the victory that didn't go all the way to Baghdad, and then the killer sanctions, where many innocent civilians were injured by policies spearheaded by the U.S. And then after that, another war, now an occupation. It's a very complex and densely interwoven situation. I just saw this. I heard this last night on the radio, and I'm looking at it on the computer screen now. CNN is saying General Richard Myers told reporters Tuesday that the number of insurgent attacks has run between 50 and 60 a day for the past in the past week, up from a recent average about 40 a day. In terms of the number of incidents, it's right about where it was 1 year ago, he said. And weeks will differ, and months will differ a little bit. But if you look at the scope of this over time since May 2003, that's the conclusion you draw. So he said half of those attacks are ineffective, but basically the opposition in Iraq is still there, and it's still about equally powerful.
Well, I'm amazed that Richard Myers, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, actually said that, because to me he's a guy that's in the hip pocket of Donald Rumsfeld. It would not have been surprising to me that the U.S. commander in Iraq maybe would have said that, but actually I'm kind of stunned because it is an admission that the military prowess, the might of the most mighty military force in the world, yet again stumbles when there is a grassroots insurgent group that is bent on making sure that an invader and occupier does not meet with success. And for somebody like General Myers to have acknowledged that, admitted it, to me is a major, that is a major important statement that we should recognize as being yet another crack in the facade of the political administration's attempt to convey to the U.S. public that everything's rosy. Few minor problems, but indeed democracy is well on its way. Just because there was an election held in January where the whole country was locked down, mm-hmm. and an extra 30,000 to 50,000 U.S. troops went in there to make sure that no cars were on the roads, and that anybody that was coming into the zone, the election zone, the zone of democracy, could be picked off by sharpshooters that were on buildings all around the area where the voting booths were.
This isn't what we would call an election in the United States.
It certainly isn't. And, I mean, granted, the people of Iraq that did take the chance to go out on the streets in that very dangerous, dangerous time and to go vote, I mean, I'm proud of them. I'm proud of for their doing that. But that does not say that one day of very controlled elections a democracy makes. And indeed, it was the choice of the insurgent group not to take on this extra military force at that time. I mean, it was a tactical decision that they made not to go ahead and disrupt that. It wasn't that they couldn't. They could have, but they decided not to risk their troops at that time or their groups. You look at what's happened after the election and the inability of those who were elected during that day in January to form a government and to really come to a consensus on which ethnic group or religious group gets what spoils of democracy.
I guess we have had the election and this new government is supposedly in place, but we're still running under the provisional U.S. appointed government, as I understand it.
Pretty much so. I mean,
months later,
and even with the great pressure of Donald Rumsfeld and Condoleezza Rice telling this new elected group, you've got to come up with your cabinet. You can't diddle around anymore. You've got to, it's important that this election be consolidated and that you get moving, you take your positions and take over, you know, your own sovereignty. Well, I think we see by their indecision that there's a lot of behind-the-scenes maneuvering that's still going on, and we should expect that because that is the way of that part of the country, and particularly coming out of a period of nearly 20 years under Saddam Hussein, where they didn't have the chance to debate, or the debates ended with only one group getting the spoils.
Or when those who were ready to debate went into exile and, became kind of calcified in some way, being out of touch with the people.
That's right.
So that here you have opposition groups, but the opposition groups find it hard to link up with the people who survived all those years of isolation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that Iraq is one of the issues that you resigned over. The others, the Israeli-Palestinian situation.
Yes. Well, to me, that's the fundamental dangerous situation in the Middle East. And until that's resolved, there will continue to be all sorts of situations that will develop out of that. And in general, it is a perception, if not a reality, of the unbalanced policies of the United States in that situation, that indeed we have not used our influence properly, that we have not, and particularly in the time of the Bush administration, their decision to go along with the violence in the latest intifada. Thank you. But I mean, horrible things that were going on, where you had young Palestinians that were strapping bombs to themselves and going in and blowing themselves, and Israeli youth and men and women and restaurants and all blowing those up, and then you'd have Israelis going in and with bulldozers just mowing down Palestinian villages, and the United States, which does have influence. In fact, we've got the greatest influence, I think, on both of those groups. We give the Israelis $4 billion a year. We give the Palestinian Authority the money that they've had over the last years.
So not anywhere near what Israel or Egypt gets, but we're also supporting Egypt, which is sort of the Palestinians' big brother.
Mm-hmm.
So in theory, we should be able to exert all kinds of influence on all parties concerned.
Well, that's right. We should. And in the past, we have in some degrees, and even under the Clinton administration. I mean, they came very close to getting some type of an agreement, which hopefully would have prevented this last bloodshed. But the Bush administration just did not want to follow through on anything that Bill Clinton did on any level, whether it was in the Middle East or whether it was in North Korea. And as a result, they let get out of control, so to speak, some very, very dangerous situations in the world. And the lack of balance of policies in the Israeli-Palestinian thing, of course, feeds the anti-American feeling all over the world, because all of the groups that are kind of going after the United States say that is their number one gripe against the United States, our unbalanced policies, our total support for Israel and to hell with the Palestinians sort of thing. And yet the good work that's been done by American negotiators was just thrown out the window by the Bush administration.
Yeah, it's so obvious if you're paying attention to what's going on there that they get almost to the threshold of an agreement and then all this support just sort of vanished.
And mm-hmm. Well, and the Bush administration did not do anything to move right in after their election in 2000 to consolidate, to start to move forward. In fact, they wouldn't even appoint a negotiator.
Yeah, wouldn't talk to the people. Yeah.
No, and then the same thing in the North Korean situation. I mean, talk about a really dangerous predicament for the northeastern part of Asia, where you have a state that is led by a unstable character, and who had been working with the United
earlier.
States and the international community on moving from nuclear weapons to nuclear energy. And then there were some difficulties,
of course.
The U.S.
had made a promise that they would provide some fuel for them mm-hmm. in exchange for their giving up their weapons program.
Yes.
And the fuel wasn't forthcoming, or some of the preliminary material wasn't forthcoming. They were going to provide energy in the interim.
Yes.
And that didn't arrive, so that the North Koreans were understandably upset.
Yes. And we were providing food for them, wheat and things like that. And there was a gap in the U.S. Fulfilling its part of the agreement, and also the Japanese government was a part of this too. The situation was that the Bush administration needed to follow up and get moving, at least start talking to them. But no, for 2 years, the administration said, we'll study the problem, we'll study it. Well, it's kind of like I think George Bush feels about the leader of North Korea like he felt like the leader of the Palestinians. I'm not ever going to talk to these guys. They're going to die before I have anything to do with them. And in fact, he waited out Yasser Arafat. Arafat died, and the way that it was looking like the U.S. Studying the issue in North Korea that went on 2 years with doing nothing, he was going to do that until the North Koreans said to the international community in some pretty dramatic ways, like sending missiles over Japan or accosting vessels at sea, like, you'd better start talking to us. And it was really the rest of the international community that really puts great pressure on the United States, saying, we have got to talk to them. We, the international community, we intend to. And, in fact, it's through bilateral talks.
Insisting on multinational talks.
Multinational, yes.
Because the bilateral ones with the U.S. weren't going to happen, I guess.
That's right. And so the U.S. was dragged into these multilateral talks, kicking and screaming. But at least, it's the international community is in many ways moving our very obstinate policies, because they recognize the threat that the United States and its policies are to the world. So they're taking their own measures to try to undercut many of the policies of the Bush administration.
We have to admire the Chinese for going along and sort of taking up the slack when the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
wasn't forthcoming.
Surely, yeah.
So anyway, the Israeli-Palestinian situation is a key situation because it's a continuous explosion. It's kind of a birthing place for other conflicts that's not going to go away until there is a peace treaty there.
That's right.
And other things that you were worried about were, there is the... the lack of having a policy on North Korea at all. You didn't mention Iran at the time, I suppose.
Well, even with those four that I mentioned and kind of going into them a little greater detail in my letter, the letter was still 3.5 pages long.
Yeah.
And it was the longest in the history of the State Department on resignation. If you had the litany of all the things that everyone ought to be concerned about, it's a book.
Yeah, but you weren't ready to write a book, and at least I suppose the internet connections to Mongolia still aren't perfectly up to snuff.
Oh, well, actually they're pretty good out there, but you know, you have to pick your battles, and so I picked four major ones that I really felt were the keys right then at that point. And certainly the whole issue of Iran is very important. I mean, there are a lot of things that we've got to be considering. Right now, to me, the whole issue of the Patriot Act is, which I refer to also as in my letter of resignation, the unnecessary curtailment of civil liberties under that Patriot Act is very, very dangerous for us. And even though the FBI will say, you know, we've never used those provisions that say that we will look at what you're reading at the library. Well, talk to some librarians who say they've been visited. Yeah,
the librarians aren't allowed to tell.
That's right. Yeah, and nobody can tell you what's going on with your internet connection and who's monitoring what you are doing on the internet. And
there's this, and there's also imprisonment without trial. Lots of different rationales for that. It's not just the Patriot Act, but it seems to be much more common to just bypass what we have always assumed were Magna Carta or constitutional guarantees, and just lock people up that you don't like and keep them there for a long time.
Well, that's right. A lot of in the places that I speak, people ask me, is there any government retaliation on you for speaking out and for having resigned from the government and then speaking out over these last 2 years? And I said, well, other than the fact that I seem to get stopped at every airport and have special extra screening, seem to be on somebody's list on that, but more concerning to me is the fact that I could walk outside your studios and somebody can just present a badge and say, come with me. And I said, well, why? We don't have to tell you.
National security.
They don't have to tell my family, and they wouldn't. I can be locked up and you can be locked up for as long as they want to keep you locked up, and they don't have to bring you before a judge within 48 hours. They don't have to charge you with anything. All they have to do is say, links to terrorism. So it's something we have to be concerned about because we don't even know the extent of it, of how many Americans have been put in our own jails here. We do know that there are a lot of people from other countries that have been jailed in our country and that our country has been the ringleader in picking up citizens of other countries in other parts of the world and rendering them to secret prisons, rendering them to countries that are known for their torture activities like Egypt and Jordan and Tunisia. So these are things that we need to be in constant contact with our congressmen and women to tell them that they've got to get some spine, that they have got to get some courage, they've got to get some confidence in themselves to stand up and speak for the American public and the protection of our liberties. And if they don't stand up and if they don't get these provisions of the Patriot Act changed, then they ought to be defeated. They ought to be defeated on that issue. I mean, if they are so lily-livered, so chicken about taking on our, you know, the federal government on these things, then kick them out of office.
Yeah. And in Britain, they're having a similar problem. The longstanding rule that people couldn't be tried twice for the same crime has been eliminated from English law. And people who committed crimes 30 years ago and where new evidence has come forward are being retried on the same charges. This kind of thing could start happening here. We have a constitution, but how that constitution is interpreted depends on who the judge is doing the interpreting.
Yeah.
So there are other issues that we probably are going to touch on later in the show. In Peterborough the other night, you talked a little bit about how you got into the military and then into